Welcome to Resurrection Recovery, a ministry of hope and healing provided by Church of the Resurrection. This podcast is produced by Resurrection Recovery participants as a way to share their experience, strength, and hope as they move through the recovery journey. You can join us every Thursday night at 6 p.m. for a community meal and a personal story, and then support groups at 7 p.m. Check our website at core.org/recovery for special events, location, and a group that might fit your need.
Thank you all for coming tonight and listening to me speak. So as Tom said, my name is Nick, and I have been sober since March 29th of 2011. Thank you. So, you know, part of it, to tell my story, there's some, precursors to what made me fall in love with drugs and alcohol in the first place. And so, growing up, I was always a really active kid. I grew up in a small town just outside of St. Louis in Illinois. And so, you know, I went to school with the same, 30 kids or whatever it was, from the time I was 4 or 5 years old until, eighth grade. From there, I went to, my dad wanted me to go to a private Catholic all-boys school, which, at 14, I was not a huge fan of. And more than anything, the reason I was not a huge fan of it had more to do with the fact that I didn't know anybody there, right? I showed up, and again, having gone through most of my time in school, it was the same kids. We all knew each other. We were all friends. I was comfortable. I was safe. I was secure. And I was accepted. That was the other thing, is ultimately, a majority of my story was I just constantly was searching for somebody to accept me. Now, I was a wild child growing up. I got in a lot of trouble. I got in a lot of fights. Anytime, if I ever got sent to the principal's office, I would say that I didn't do it, but you can bet that I did, whatever it was. And so, a lot of it, I just wanted to be the center of attention. I hated not being the center of attention. And so when I went to that high school, my freshman year of high school was really, really rough, more so than anything, truly because I didn't have a whole lot of people that I felt like I was friends with or that I was close to, right? And at 14, 15 years old, that was a pretty difficult thing to navigate or know how to deal with. Add to it too, so I was adopted from Russia. I was a year old when I was adopted. I was born in Moscow. That definitely added to some things as well, all the attachment disorder pieces and all of that. So, I really was kind of screwed from the beginning in some ways, right? It was just a kind of perfect series of events that led to feeling really isolated and alone, right? My sophomore year of high school, I remember vividly, I had this Spanish class, and there was this group of like 3 or 4 guys that sat in front of me. And one of the things that I would remember is every Monday morning they would come in and they would talk about the weekend that they just had. And they would talk about the parties they went to and drinking and hanging out with girls and all of this other stuff that to me sounded like paradise, and not so much because I really wanted to drink. At that point, I had never drank, smoked pot, any of it. But more because of the way that they told the stories, they were excited. And it was like they had their own little secret that nobody else got to be a part of, right? And that was something that I wanted. And that was something that I searched for virtually my entire life. I'd always wanted to be a part of something greater, right? So, I weaseled my way into hanging out with them one weekend. And because I wasn't friends with them, right? Like, they just sat in front of me. And they pretty much felt the same way. Like, we don't really know you. You're just the guy who sits behind us and laughs at our stories, right? So I weaseled my way into hanging out with them. And God bless my parents. They didn't see it coming. But they had, they're not drinkers, right? Like, they're not party animals, anything like that. And so they, at different Christmas parties or birthday parties, they would kind of just accumulate alcohol. And then they would just shove it on this shelf above our pantry and then never touch it, right? And it was all hard liquor. They weren't beer drinkers. They weren't hard liquor drinkers. They really didn't drink at all. But so at 15, that was like a treasure trove, right? I had just found the jackpot. There was probably easily 30, 40 bottles of alcohol that you know, lined that shelf. So, you know, I was like, well, if I take one, they're not going to notice. You know, I mean, nobody's going to know the difference, and they don't drink, they never check it. So I stole a fifth of vodka and took it to school with me and was all excited because I was like, you know, this is going to be awesome. So, you know, me being 15 years old and dumb, I pulled it out in class and was like, hey, check it out, whatever. And they were like, dude, put that away, you know. And but I was like, look, let me in. You know, I just wanted to be a part of that so badly. So we ended up going to a buddy of mine, Nick. His best friend growing up moved to Colorado, but his parents had kept their house in St. Louis, but nobody lived in it. But his friend left Nick a spare key, right? It was a pretty nice house and a nice suburb in St. Louis County. And so we, you know, we didn't break in technically, we had a key. And we, you know, basically what we would do is we would go there and we would drink. We would invite people over. But the only kicker was that we couldn't turn the lights on because all the neighbors knew that everybody else was, they lived in Colorado, right? So what we did was we got flashlight, because this was before iPhones and all of that, but, you know, 9 years, 8 years ago, well, I guess it was like 11 years ago now, but we had to get the like little Rayovac light lanterns or whatever from Walmart for like 25 cents, and they're like that big and whatever, because we were 15 and spent all of our money on booze. And so so I remember the first time I ever drank, I really wasn't that interested in the drinking aspect, at least not until I drank, right? I was more interested in what do these people think of me, right? One of the guys had invited a couple of older girls, and so obviously I was, even though I wanted to be the center of attention, I was also very, very highly insecure. I was never very confident in myself. I never really believed highly of myself, any of that. So while they're all drinking, I was sitting on the couch, like off to the side, kind of awkwardly, and you know, just didn't really know how to interact or what to say. Because again, these guys weren't my friends. I had realistically had a couple laughs with them at school and that was it, you know? So eventually one of the girls, I think, had realized, you know, one of these things is not like the other and I'm off by myself and everybody else is getting trashed. And so she came over and was like, what's wrong with you? What's going on? Whatever. And essentially just went, here, drink this, right? And she had mixed some of the vodka that I'd stolen with Red Bull. And, you know, so the first thing that was weird was when I drank alcohol, I didn't mind the taste at all. I actually kind of liked it. There's a lot about me where I truly believe I was kind of built to drink. I didn't get hangovers. I could count on one hand the amount of times I've had a hangover. I could also count on one hand the amount of times, not just when I was drinking, but in my life that I've thrown up. These were not things that happened for me. And so I started drinking and, you know, I didn't drink heavily at first, but eventually I started to feel buzzed, right? And I can tell you the exact moment that I knew I'd fallen in love with alcohol was I started to have that feeling and everything felt like it melted away. How scared I was to be around these guys and girls, how insecure I was. I mean, truly everything went away. It was like magic. It was like, I don't understand why nobody's ever told me about how this feels. You know, I couldn't wrap my head around how people had kept this from me. And from then on, I was not one of those people that there was a progression. I was straight out the gate. I knew what I had found and I had found my calling. And, you know, I was gonna drink till the day I died is the way that I had felt. And somewhere in there, I had smoked pot. So I had smoked pot a handful of times and never gotten high because I, you know, had never smoked anything. So the whole idea of inhaling never occurred to me, you know. And eventually, like the fourth or fifth time that I had smoked pot, I got high. And it was the same exact feeling. I mean, it was this, how could people have kept this from me? Like, food tastes better, music sounds better. Like, I don't know how much time has passed, but I don't really care, you know? I mean, it was incredible, right? And I was able to keep it a secret for a while, which is honestly, looking back, kind of surprising because I just hit the ground running. I mean, it was full blown. I mean, being 15, I mean, the most that I think I could get high in a week was like three or four times. And that was only because I didn't have a car yet, honestly. Once I got a car, that changed everything. First time my parents caught me, they really tried to do right by me. They really tried to do what they knew how to do, which was ground me. And you know, props to them. They put up with a lot of stuff, but that just didn't do anything, you know. All that meant was I had to get to school a little bit earlier so I could get high before school. That was what that meant to me. And so the day I got ungrounded was the same day I got my driver's license. And within 15 minutes, my car was already filled with weed smoke. And within 2 hours, I had bought, I'd saved up all my money for a week so that I could buy 230 cases of beer, and I had them in the back seat driving around from party to party to party. So one of my calling cards when I was in high school was being a drunk driver. It's not something I'm proud of, but that was, I truly thought it was funny, and I thought that I was skilled at it, right? And I was also a blackout drunk, so that was also kind of scary. The entire month of February of 2010, I really couldn't tell you what happened. I have zero recollection, and there's different pockets of my life where I don't have any memories from, and I can't remember a single thing. And that's not, you know, as I've gotten older, that was even a couple months after February of 2010, I couldn't remember what happened, you know. I remember my dad, I think it was probably like the end of the year, and he had some homework assignment I had done, like, you know, February 11th, 2010, whatever. And I was like, I have no memory of even doing this paper, you know. So things started to get a little bit rough. At that point, though, I was still kind of flying under the radar with my folks until March 12th, 2010. I had gotten arrested, and it really was kind of ridiculous. So, you know, by 10 o'clock that night, I had already drank a fifth of vodka again, and everybody else, well, a couple things happened. You know the neighborhoods that have the, like, community pools and community pool houses, right? Well, I had successfully gotten everybody kicked out of a party because I started punching holes in the wall because I lost a game of beer pong. And so from there, my idea was, well, now I have to make up for it because I just got everybody kicked out. So I offered up my buddy Matt's neighborhood community pool house as, well, we'll just break into that and we'll just move our party there. So rather than doing that, we ended up doing like $25,000 worth of damage to the inside, to the property as a whole, which I don't have many memories of at all. And then from there, I decided at that point it was like 1 a.m, and I decided that I wanted to smoke pot. So I had bought a bag of weed and was sitting in this parking lot with a guy I barely knew, and we were smoking pot. And I remember looking up, and there was what looked to be a giant mansion right across the street from us. And there was cars driving in and out of it. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, after I smoke this bowl, I'm gonna go over there and crash that party. And then I blacked out, and the next thing I remember is waking up in jail. So what had happened was that giant mansion was a police station. So I was literally smoking weed 50 yards from the front of the police station and didn't even realize it because I was that hammered. And so, you know, I wasn't very good at, like, being secretive once I was drunk. From there, things just got pretty bad pretty quick. The week after that, I drank like a fifth and a half of Captain Morgan and blacked out drunk, and I don't remember a single thing. What I found out later was that my parents found me passed out on my garage floor, not breathing. So that was the week after I'd gotten arrested. And then that following Friday after they had found me not breathing and all of that, I got caught selling pot at school. So, you know, it was pretty bad 3 weeks. And my parents were kind of at their wits' end at that point because it was no longer, for them, I think it kind of just felt like it was all coming out of nowhere, you know, of this, you know, we had some idea, but we didn't realize how bad, right? At that point, what they should have done was they should have taken me to treatment immediately. Unfortunately, they didn't know that. They didn't have those resources. They didn't have that understanding, right? And I don't fault them for that. I mean, they did the best they could. So from there, they got me a job at a machine shop where essentially my job was to be just manual labor. All I did was all day long move these giant metal beams from these loading trucks into the warehouse all day. So you know, that summer I really didn't drink or use that much because I would get home at like 8 o'clock and pass out because I was exhausted. The couple times that I did drink or smoke pot, I got caught. At this point, I kind of stopped caring whether anybody knew or not, you know, and I didn't try hiding it. If I could get away with hiding it, cool. If I didn't, whatever, you know. And so I was 16 at this point. And the beginning of my junior year, really this switch went off where I just stopped caring about everything except for drinking. The first semester of my junior year, I have like 3 memories and they're all drug related. I remember snorting Percocet off my desk in class. I remember taking acid after having drank all night. Those are really the only 2 memories I have. I took the ACT on a bunch of muscle relaxers and opiates, like random ones that I'd found because my dad had a knee surgery. But that was it. And at this point, everything around me was starting to fall apart. The best way I think I could describe myself was a hurricane, but I was in the eye of the hurricane. Everything to me really seemed like I don't understand why everybody around me is freaking out. I mean, everything is fine. And I really thought that I was just like every other kid around me. I really didn't think things were that bad or, you know, whether it be with my parents or my brother or even my friends or school, nothing to me seemed like it was really that awful. And when my parents would get on me about this is a problem, this, that, the other, my friends started to get on me. I couldn't see it. You know, I just could not understand what people were talking about. And so by this point, you know, I wasn't a very good friend. I mean, every time my friends would hang out with me, like their drugs or money would go missing. And I'd be like, well, I don't know. I don't know what happened. And let me help you find it. Like I would just steal from people and then help them find what I stole and pretending like I was being a good friend and things like that. I mean, I was just a con. I was a liar. I did not care for a second about anybody else around me. When I would get blackout drunk and I would get angry, I, you know, would get pretty violent at points. And I was really, really angry at this point. And that was my way for, I guess you could say, covering up the way that I really felt, which, I was just walking around constantly hurt, constantly afraid. And, things got worse and worse and worse. By that point, I started drinking every day. My parents had started to catch on to the fact that all the alcohol above our pantry started to go missing. But by the time they realized it, again, there was probably 30 or 40 bottles there. By the time they realized it, I think there was 7 left. So throughout the course of a year, I had essentially just taken all of it. And when I couldn't steal from them, what I would do, my buddy David, his brother was 21, and so I would just get his brother to buy me alcohol. And at that point, I was doing a lot of really unhealthy things. I was prescribed to Adderall, and I didn't take it because I had, well, I took it, I was supposed to take it because I had ADHD, but I started taking it in excess so that I wouldn't eat, so I could save all my lunch money to buy drugs and alcohol. So, you know, by this point, I'm like stick thin and don't look very good either. And so, you know, it was, it was really, really rough. And going into Christmas break, my buddy Sean invited me to go on this cruise with him, and that was like the coolest thing in the world, right? And his parents didn't care. They were like, look, as long as we don't see you guys doing whatever you're doing, we'll pretend it's not happening. So I essentially got to go on this like 12-day cruise with zero supervision. And my parents sent me off with, you know, hundreds of dollars and a, you know, a couple different countries that don't have a drinking age. And it was awesome. So for 12 straight days, I would wake up at 10 in the morning and I would start drinking and I wouldn't stop till like 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, and then wake up and do the same thing. At that point, I had been drinking for like a month or two straight. And when I got back from that cruise, I'd spent my first day sober in like, you know, 2 or 3 months. And I woke up, I remember I woke up in my bed and realized I was back in St. Louis. I had to go to school the next day, and I was furious, and I was miserable. I remember being really, really depressed because I was like, nothing will ever compare to the trip that I just had. You know, it really was. It was like, there's no way that I could ever find something that was as great as that. So from there, my parents at that point had realized my drinking was a problem, so they came down on me pretty hard with a lot of that stuff. But I was still able to smoke pot every day, and it was probably a month before I got sober. I remember I was leaving. I would have to wake up at like 6 or 6:30 every day to get to school because it was an hour away from my house. And so there was one day, well, there was a week straight where I was waking up at 5:30 every day just so I could get to school an hour early so I could smoke pot before school. Well, buy it and smoke pot. And I remember there was this one day I was doing that, and you know, my dad was in the Marine Corps for 20 plus years, so you know, he was always up super early. And I remember he was standing in the doorway, and he just looked at me and went, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Well, I'm going to school. What are you doing? Because this is weird." And he was like, "Well, I don't want you going to school." He had caught on, like I was going to school early, buying drugs and getting high. And so I, you know, did what I always did, which is I started screaming, yelling, cursing at him, all of it, and he would not get out of the doorway. And so I started, and my dad's quite a bit bigger than me, right? I mean, a lot a bit bigger than me. But so I started throwing punches at him and, you know, told him I hated him, that I wanted nothing to do with him, get out of my way, this, that, the other. And I'll never forget the way he looked at me, because it was the first time that I realized on some level the damage I was doing to him and my mom, you know, because he looked at me and he hadn't quite started crying, but it was there. I'd never seen my dad cry in my entire life. The only other time I had seen him cry was when he picked me up from jail, but I was so mad at him in that moment that I had just no remorse for him. But that day before going to school was when I really realized some of the damage I was doing. And from then on, for the next month or so, I was just miserable. And, you know, it was the second to last time I used, I basically got robbed and I just hit this breaking point. A couple months before this had happened, there was a guy I went to school with who, he had gone through a treatment program himself, and he had given me the number for this treatment program, and, you know, I put it in my wallet and forgot all about it. But when I got robbed, it was by one of my childhood best friends. It was a guy I grew up with, just stole a bunch of money and drugs from me. And so at that point, I'd hit this breaking point where I was like, I'm done. You know, I mean, by that point, none of the people I was friends with really wanted to be friends with me anymore. Things with my parents had gotten so bad that me and my dad were either screaming or fighting, or we weren't speaking at all. And I wouldn't speak to my mom at all at this point. And so things were just terrible, and I was starting to come to terms with that and have a moment of clarity. And so I gave my mom the number to that treatment program, and she called them, and then the very next day we went to Colorado for spring break. And it was the first time since I had started using that I spent a week sober. The entire week I didn't get high once, and the only reason I didn't is because they were watching me like a hawk, like they would not let me out of their sight. And but I remember after that week, we got back to St. Louis and I felt insane. I mean, I hadn't drank, I hadn't smoked pot in a week. I'd never done that, at least not since I started. And so I remember calling everybody in my phone that I could possibly think of who would have anything, something. I didn't even care what. And everybody that I normally would call basically went, "Lose my number. I don't want to talk to you. I want nothing to do with you." And so I had the idea of, okay, well, if I can't find anybody who used to be friends with me, maybe I can find somebody who was never friends with me. There was a guy named Evan who hated me. I mean, could not stand me. And, you know, for good reason. And it was over a girl. And, you know, I'll spare the details, but I was fully to blame. And so I called him and went, "Look, I know you really don't like me, and that's fine. I'm fine with that. I just need to get high. So if I come to your house, will you let me get high first, and then you can do whatever. If you want to beat me up, beat me up. If you want to yell at me, yell at me. I don't care. Just let me get high first." And he went, "Okay, deal." So I drove to his house, and I walked into his basement, and I got really, really lucky because he also had a drug problem and had eaten a bunch of Xanax earlier that day and was passed out. And so I did what any good addict would do, and I smoked his pot, and then I booked it out of there. And I was driving around that night, and that was the last time I got high. And I was driving around that night by myself and realized that I had nobody to call, I had nowhere to go, and I had nothing to do. And I hit this moment of certainty that I knew I didn't want my life to be this way anymore, right? And I was, at that point, I was still high, but I smoking weed for me or drinking or any of that, it was no longer this magical 10 the way that it was the first time I got high, you know? I mean, it just wasn't. And I would drink and smoke weed just to be normal, you know? I was not going to a 10, I was going to like a 2, you know? But when I was sober, it felt like I was at like -8. You know, I mean, I just hated my life and everything around me, including myself. So the day after that, I went into an appointment at that treatment program and decided I was going to try it out and give it a shot. And I figured worst comes to worse, this is a tolerance break. And when I go to get high, it's going to be really awesome, right? And not only that, but I'll have completed treatment. My parents will be off my back, so they'll trust me and I can do whatever I want. You know, I mean, that was what I entered into treatment thinking, was like, I'm going to literally fool everybody here into thinking that I am doing something right, you know? What ended up happening was there was a guy, he was 23 years old, he had 3 years sober, and I vividly remember everybody I was in treatment with would fight each other, not physically, but would scream and yell and whatever to get in this guy's car after group every day to go hang out with them. And the reason they would is because he was really happy, right? Like he would walk around singing, dancing. I vividly remember he showed up one day to the treatment center in like a full-blown like blue starter jumpsuit outfit, weird thing with a headband on, blasting the Space Jam soundtrack in his car and like headbanging to it, right? That was how he would show up. And it was so clear this dude just loved his life so much and how happy he was. And I remember sitting thinking to myself, like, I want whatever it is you have. It was the same feeling I had had when I would hear those guys talk about getting drunk. Like, whatever you have, I don't have it. And I want it. And so I picked him up as a sponsor. It was a 12-step. Treatment center, 12-step program, and I picked him up as a sponsor, and you know, as happy as he was and as funny as he was and all of that, he was also, I mean, he was a hard ass. I mean, he did not take anything from me, and I was angry first getting sober. I was really angry, and so there were a lot of things he would tell me to do, and I would start screaming and yelling and cursing and go, I'm not going to do that, and this, that, and the other, and he'd go, fine, then go back to what your life was before. If you really don't want what I have, tell me that right now and go back to doing what you were doing before. And every time it would stop me in my tracks because he had called my bluff, you know? I mean, he knew that I did not want to go back to the way that things were. The hardest part for me first getting sober was surrender. I didn't want to give up my way of doing things. You know, I was 17. I thought I had it all figured out. I thought I knew how everything should go and what it should look like. And, you know, you can't tell me anything because I know what I'm doing and this, that, the other. And going through any 12-step program, that's not gonna work, right? Like, you're not gonna get anywhere doing that. And for a little while, I didn't. There came a point where I remember sitting in group one day and everybody was talking about how great their lives had been because they were honest about what was going on with them and what they were thinking and feeling and all of that. And I remember sitting there being like, God, this is so stupid. And somebody looked at me and was like, you know, at what point are you just gonna give up? At what point are you gonna try to stop doing it your way? And I don't know why, because it's not as if that was the first time I had heard that, but for whatever reason in that moment, I think it was probably because he just challenged me, and so kind of as an F you, I went, okay, fine, here's everything. And I started talking about everything that was going on with me. And by the end of it all, the craziest thing had happened, which was I felt better than I had ever felt in my life, even from getting high, right? And it was weird to me. I didn't want to stick around. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to work the 12 steps. I didn't want to do any of that. The reason I did truly was because I was given something better than I could have ever had getting high. You know, going through step 3 specifically for me was a big turning point when I found a real relationship with God. And again, I grew up Catholic. So, you know, for a long time, I hated religion, hated God, hated the idea of all of it. And what I mean by, you know, my relationship with God, what that looks like today is it's not in theory, it's in action, right? When people showed up and went, look, if you do things this way, you will be blessed with a life beyond your wildest dreams. They didn't lie to me. It kept getting better. Part of the reason I still go to meetings, do everything that I do today is because it hasn't stopped getting better. And I've even, you know, I tell my sponsor and other people all the time, if at any point this stops being better than getting high was, I'll go back to it. It just, that hasn't happened, right? Like I could never have imagined that my life would be as wonderful as it is today. And a large majority of that came not only from working the steps, but from the people around me. If ultimately surrender is what it takes and not doing it my way is what it takes, it's not just a relationship with God, but I need other people in my life. As much as I like to think I know everything, I don't know anything. You know, coming up on 9 years sober, I still don't know anything. And I still have to ask questions. I still have to ask for help. That's what it takes. Still, to this day, that's what it takes. I work for a 12-step support group, and so I work with 35 teenagers, and I make a joke to them all the time. Like, you know, part of the reason I'm constantly on the phone and calling people isn't just because I like talking, but it's because I always have to ask, what else can I do? Is there something I'm doing wrong? What should this look like? I mean, I have to be that humble. My life quite literally depends on it, right? So it is, you know, that is, for me, the biggest pieces of recovery that matter, you know? And I don't know. I mean, that is my story and where I come from and what worked for me. So thank you all for listening. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you would like more information about this ministry or Church of the Resurrection, visit our website at core.org/recovery, where you can find a listing of support groups that meet every Thursday. If you would like more immediate attention, our congregational care ministries have several support options such as prayer requests, counseling, etc. at core.org/care. Thank you for listening today.